And are you willing to expand your intellectual discernment to really think about how and why and what populations and communities have been marginalized long before you had that crunch or had that restriction or had that fear? And are you able to look at them and the truth telling that they've done and the solutions that they've come up with to really enrich the collective? And are you willing to support them so that you can therefore support yourself, so that we can all be liberated and aligned to make good decisions about the future of this world?
You've tuned in to How It Looks From Here, Life in the Time of Climate Change. Here in the mashup of reality and uncertainty, life looks different to you than it does to me. The way race and gender, education and work, and everyday circumstances combine in any person's experience, well, it's different. For every person, how it looks matters. So we offer these interviews as ways of giving us all new ideas and inspiration for making our way forward together. My name's Mary Claire, and today I have the wonderful opportunity to speak with Serena Boston Ashby. Serena is currently the Chief Executive Officer of Girls, Inc. of the Pacific Northwest, an organization that serves girls and youth across the gender spectrum in Portland, Oregon, Southwest Washington, and Seattle. Serena grew up in Portland, raised in a family focused on social justice and business leadership. She's an alumna of Spelman College, the historically black college for women in Atlanta, Georgia. For 19 years, Serena has been a leader for high-profile public affairs campaigns focused on healthcare access, youth development, and nonprofit leadership. She was the first director of the Portland African American Leadership Forum, Imagine Black, and led the Oregon Public Health Institute as that organization's CEO. More recently, she's co-directed the Oregon office of D.C.-based Hilltop Public Solutions as a partner in providing strategy solutions for nonprofit and private sector clientele. Serena is also an International Women's Forum Global Leadership Fellow. In our conversation, Serena and I take a close and loving look at the climate interests and concerns of girls, young women, gender nonconforming, gender non-binary, and trans youth. You'll also hear Serena's insights at the intersection of Black feminism and environmental thought. Serena Boston Ashby, it is so great to see you and so wonderful to have you here on How It Looks From Here.
Thank you.
How are you doing today?
I am doing well. I am so grateful to be here. I've been looking forward to this for a couple of months, I believe. So thank you for hosting me. I'm very excited to have a great conversation with you today.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. Yes. So here's the deal. This podcast has the title, How It Looks From Here, Life in the Time of Climate Change. But let's just go with that first, How It Looks From Here. What would you say in response to the question, today, right now, how does it look?
Wow, what a great question. Are you speaking in terms of thinking of climate change or just where I see it today?
I think that's, I'm asking in a way that is just to tap into whatever, wherever your heart and mind are right now.
Mm-hmm. You know, how it looks is, I feel like the energy is clearing across the world, almost as if there's a restoration to, I think, many of the, I'll be very open and candid, evil constructs that have disoriented and confused and destabilized people who are doing good. From where I see it today, this morning, here in Portland, Oregon, United States, is a clearing of that energy. And I think that I am monitoring how people are avoiding negativity, avoiding a lot of that dystopian mythology that's being shoved down our throats so that we can feel confused or upset or distracted. I'm monitoring how people are avoiding that negativity and choosing to not digest it and instead find good, find the correct news, and align themselves with what we really need to be doing to restore this world and get good work done. That's really how I see it, and that's really where my energy and my attention span has been going lately.
Well, I thank you for that. In that context, what would you say that you're seeing in terms of climate interest and climate anxiety among the girls and the non-binary and trans youth that Girls Inc. is serving right now?
So at Girls Inc. of the Pacific Northwest, we are a gender-affirming youth development organization. I mean, we really did start off being known for gender specificity because our national organization was really found off of that thrust, you know, many, many, many decades ago. I think in becoming gender affirming, we have grounded ourselves in youth-led advocacy. So advocacy that is created, designed, and carried out based on what young people say we need to be doing, and giving them those resources and tools so that they can lead us through change. And top issue, I'd say top five that they bring up consistently is climate change. I think one of the things that's really true about the conversation of environmentalism, conservation, energy, climate control, is that it's a very adult-led conversation by stakeholders that are either profiting from the margin of loss, so either us moving further into climate instability, or they're profiting from the mechanics of stabilizing those the climate. But they are adults who really are not looking at the root cause or the locations in which people who are living through climate change are experiencing every day. And our youth at Girls Inc. Are talking about that very much.
Yeah, I'm so, as you know, because of my relationship with this particular organization,
yes,
I am so delighted with this opportunity for girls, many of whom otherwise would not gain access to encouragement as public leaders, are getting,
yes,
as citizen leaders, are
yes,
getting this kind of support. And that they are, it doesn't surprise me that they're interested in climate
right
repair. What are you seeing, or do you know if the people who work with you, who are directly in contact with the youth, are seeing a lot of climate anxiety? What are you seeing there?
I think we're seeing a lot of anxiety just in general. I also want to be very candid to say that in seeing that anxiety, we're seeing a lot of steadiness and a lot of articulation from these youth who are living through climate disruption and all kinds of reconstruction of the economy, whether it's inflation, lack of housing, lack of access to healthcare. What we're seeing is youth who are living through very anxiety-riddled times, but they're very stable because they're very articulate about seeing it for what it is.
For example, can you say, like, I would imagine that some of the trans youth are helping you all understand that the way the earth is treated is the way people are treated.
I think that I see that trans youth and gender nonconforming youth in either identity for themselves find our organization as a safe space and a safe harbor to talk about a myriad of issues from their perspectives. That is absolutely 100% true. I also think that what's interesting in the quote unquote gender construct is the way that we construct gender is based on a system of patriarchy and misogyny that also really is at the root of why our climate and our world is in disrepair at this time.
Connect those
and
dots.
So what we,
yeah, connect those
yes,
dots for listeners.
So, sure. So what we see is that the decisions to put capitalism and profit ahead of the common good, ahead of understanding science, accepting science, is part and parcel to why we do not have an appropriately supported and compensated workforce of non-white men, why we have Black, Indigenous, people of color who are living in floodplains, who are living in, you know, parts of this country, particularly in the United States, that are inundated with lack of clean air, lack of clean water, all because the system of capitalism is really being put first. And as a person who's a participant in capitalism, who is paid by the American dollar, I understand that capitalism is real. I engage in it every single day. But what forces are being enabled to really not be able to slow down and look at science, talk about science, and listen to young people? Mm-hmm. And I would go back to say, I think that the young people in our organization are very candid and very articulate in terms of, you know, they understand and accept the science of climate change. They look at the solutions. I also think that they're talking about things that are quote unquote climate change, right? Or quote unquote in that sort of umbrella. I think they're talking about, you know, I live in low income housing or supportive housing, but there's, you know, not enough public transportation for my parents to get to good paying jobs that aren't working in the middle of the night, working swing shift, where they have to take 6 or 7 bus routes to get there, right? And so when we look in, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, I'll speak about in Portland, when we look at light rail, it goes through the heart of the city or into arteries where there are nicer, more expensive housing. But we also have a diminishing amount of bus routes, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's really interesting because what that does is it sends a subtle message that the cleanest form of energy is for the people that can have the highest quality of living, nicer homes, nicer access to that light rail. For those of you who cannot afford to live along light rail and you need to be 6 or 7 or 2 or different bus routes out, right, where the air is dirtier, you know, where you are quote unquote having to depend upon a bus, that sends a message, right? And so I just think it behooves us to be paying attention to these things because I think our youth are talking about mm-hmm. that and they're living through that mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know that you were raised in Portland. And you've probably
mostly.
Yeah, I know that you went to college at Spelman in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. I did.
But I'm curious what you would say about how your attention, let's call it the natural world, to the natural world, your attention, yes, has affected you as you've grown up.
Mm-hmm. I moved to Oregon in 1987 from upstate New York. And I think the thing that I was about 8 years old at the time. I mean, I think the commonalities is that, you know, you call it the Rust Belt, call it the Snow Belt. Upstate New York is fairly green. It's very beautiful. And when we moved to Oregon, I found it the same, but very different histories in terms of indigenous peoples, how the quote unquote statehoods came to be and what the priorities were. You know, in Oregon, it's always really sort of prided itself in a very romanticized approach to environmentalism and conservation by sheer essence that, you know, whether it was Lewis and Clark or other, you know, white men that came out here, they had a vested interest in land. Yeah. Some of that was to be able to chart out new territory and to take credit for that. And that's quote unquote new territory in terms of new for them, but not for the indigenous people who had been here for thousands right. of years. And some wanted access to that land for fur trading. And, you know, essentially the idea of the environmental construct of Oregon and all of the Pacific Northwest has been based on the quote unquote founding stories of white
yes,
men.
Thank you.
And all of the, and all of the capitalism that came as a result of that. So whether it was fur trading, shipping, gold mining, other types of mineral extraction, that idea of quote unquote the environment and land was really rooted in that. And then everything really developed from there. of all kinds of things, right? It's local governments, rules, regulations, lack of accommodations for non-white men, and all of those things. I think for me, I always felt as a young person, I think very triggered, and I think very angry about that dissociation, where I think young people in my education background in Oregon were being taught to memorize maps and memorize the founding history of Oregon and sort of like this reverence for this romanticized story without being able to talk about the real things that happen in history. And what that means is that you have generations of quote unquote Oregonians or Washingtonians who have been raised really sort of with this cognitive dissonance. And then as you move into adulthood, you register to vote, you choose to be affiliated with any type of political belief, your idea of civic engagement and political analysis is based on that unless you choose to re-educate yourself, mm-hmm. right? And so for me, the natural world is something that I have had to realign myself with and really develop my own personal values. Sure, kids are taught to not litter, but what does that really mean in terms of being a steward of the earth? For me, I find comfort in nature because it really reminds me of the core of who I am, to be really spiritual, really at the core and the essence of my soul. It reminds me that, you know, I had ancestors thousands and thousands of years ago that came before me where I step on, this was not their right. home. But they had in their mind, either subconsciously or directly, to be good stewards of the world. What would they say today to me? And what do I want my two daughters? I have two daughters who are 11 and 8 years old, to know and understand about what it means to take care of the natural world and always sort of return to the earth and how you look at things. And again, we live in a world right now where some of the biggest things that are confronting us are fake news. I would say illegalizing science, making science illegal, where we really have to be so convicted about science and truth-telling and good news sourcing so that our kids in the next generation feel comfortable and equipped with good decision-making so that as they look at the earth, as they look at climate restoration, they feel comfortable and confident in what they're doing. Because as you know, to the premise of why we're here, there's only one earth that we live on.
This is Mary Claire and How It Looks From Here. Stay with us. We'll be back after this brief break. And so the story that you are telling, this is really lovely as an illustration, and I want to bring this forward for the listeners insofar as it might be helpful.
Sure.
You have mentioned that the youth that you work with are very facile. It's almost as if it's in their DNA or in something in them is able to deconstruct the messes around them and see really what's going on here, at least for a while they're young. But and you described how this separation from the natural world was something that was engineered.
Absolutely.
More or less consciously and intentionally by the dominant group that came in the name of discovery.
Sure.
And in the name of finding stuff to have and to control.
Yes.
And that's what we've all inherited, which separates all of us because of the nature of education from the natural world. And then it's up to us, with good luck, to reclaim that relationship.
Everything that you just said, I so appreciate. Yes, to all of that.
Well, I have another question that's a bit longer.
Sure.
You and I have talked a little bit about this. I'm curious for you to speak specifically about what's most misunderstood about the investment of Black women, and in particular, moms, these women have in the thought and action that's linked with ecological health. There's a scholar named Chelsea Michael Fraser. She's an eco-critic. And she speaks at length about the intersection of Black feminism with environmental thought and really calls out stereotypes of Black women. And I imagine you're probably also aware of LaToya Ruby Frazier's photography work, Flint is Family. And Chelsea Frazier speaks about how she finds consistently that the ecological sensibilities of Black women are powerfully grounded in the understanding that all of life is connected. And she emphasizes the guidance that's available from these women and mothers who clearly see and address the interconnected points of what she calls our unwell society. Could you speak to that?
I mean, I am more than glad to speak to that, although I know that I cannot speak to it better than they already have.
Of course, thank you.
I mean, I think that they are certainly of a collective voice of preeminent womenists and Black feminists and humans that have dedicated their entire life story, their everyday course of action, and their developed wisdom to better understanding, supporting Black women, and in turn, as you've just described, unlocking the keys to better understanding this world. And, you know, for the listeners, I do identify as a Black woman. I do have Black children. There is not enough that's studied in terms of understanding that, as Zora Neale Hurston, who is a famous American writer who happened to be a Black woman, said that Black women are the mules of the world, of the earth. Black women are the mules of the earth, that there is no group of women that is mistreated more than Black women. If you take that and you drill that down to looking at indigenous women within, let's say, the United States construct, that is certainly also part and parcel to where we look at the idea of the source of life in indigenous construct, going all the way back to Africa and just the dispersal and the diasporic effect of Africans throughout the world. That is definitely intrinsically linked with the experiences of indigenous women here in this country. Black women are constantly demonized, sexualized, and vilified by just the sheer essence of enslaved Africans in this country, where Black women were raped and forced to birth children for the protectivity of plantations. They were separated from their children, who were put also into fields or sold off, and they were expected to be wet nurses and as well as quote-unquote caretakers for white children. And that started the identity construct and the economic construct of what it means to be a Black woman today in this country in 2024. Everything from the inability to get access to education, the wage gap and the labor gap, or being paid less to do the same work as a different counterpart, such as a white man or a white woman, all goes back to that. With that being said, Black women have always been stewards of this earth and have always been the truth tellers in terms of what is going on with climate dysregulation.
If you look at
the issues in Louisiana, particularly around oil extraction, everything that happens along the Gulf Coast, where you had Black women who were community organizers speaking up about that long before there was Hurricane Katrina. If you look at Flint, you had the majority, because Flint has been in an economic crisis for decades. Mm-hmm. You had Black women who were doing that work, supporting their families. And this is because the idea of what it quote unquote means to be in this world is not studied enough, right? So we're willing to sort of look at white women, so their voter registration, how many homes they own, because there are these standards of measurement that are very racist that count out other types of things that we need to be measuring. And so Black women have always been there really doing the work. We're also blamed for everything, which is the perverse irony of everything, right? So, you know, we're considered welfare queens or negative or bitter simply just because we speak up about the truth of the things that we are experiencing, which means the world mm-hmm. is experiencing.
Yeah.
And so the case of Flint with lead in water, Hurricane Katrina, those are two prominent examples of places where there are high Black populations and community. There was a research study that was published today that said Black women are six times more likely to be murdered than white women, right? And so in all of that, right, that means that our cortisol levels are the highest. That is something that we are passing on through birth, where we also have the highest infant mortality rates in this country. We are passing this on, but also still expected to do the work, still expected to truth tell. And I would say as a Black woman, we do that really because we have to, right? Also with zero expectation of respect or support. But we do that because I think that that's really our legacy. What's, I think, left to be discovered is if the construct in which we're operating that's going unnoticed, not validated, undercompensated, is going to be taken on as the appropriate platform to solve a lot of these issues. And what has happened is the environmental movement, particularly climate action, has been really hijacked by white people, particularly some white women, right? When you have Black and brown women who have been doing this work and talking about this for hundreds of years. And so that is something that Black women are too vulnerable to be able to speak up alone about. We need other people to point that out, right? That we've been doing the work talking about climate issues for hundreds of years, but now, in my opinion, because it's a lucrative market, we have non-Black women and other people talking about this. Do I think that there are a cohort of people, regardless of identity, that care, that also want to validate the experiences of Black women? Sure, absolutely. But the majority of the biggest stakeholders are not engaging Black women in that truth-telling, in those problem-solvings. They're not asking for our policy recommendations. Or they're solving it in places where Black people are lower in population, and then they're going to think about getting us to us later.
All of this,
right,
and is so important.
It really is important, right? And so
it's vital to have said out loud.
That, it really
you know,
is.
Thank you for saying it.
Thank
and
you
I'm
for
glad
asking.
That we have this format. Absolutely.
Yes.
So, I think that the for our non-Black listeners, for people who were raised white, mm-hmm. who are listening to this, just slow it down a little bit and really get that this is not about you're a bad person.
No.
But it is about how there are brilliant insights and brilliant understandings based in eons of experience that go missing in this time when we don't have time to waste. Would that seem accurate to you?
I think that that would seem accurate. I think there's something about specificity that can turn people off. In that specificity gives you a better understanding of very complex issues. And if you can accept that and widen your own intellectual discernment, you will be liberated yourself. And I think it comes down to a question for white listeners, really anybody in this world. Do you want to be liberated from many of the forces that are making it difficult for us to have a high quality of life every day? Rising gas prices, rising cost of a gallon of milk, rising cost of clothes, rising cost of many, many things, the inability to buy a home in America. Are you interested in taking a harder look at the forces that are making it difficult for us to have a quote-unquote quality of life? And are you willing to expand your intellectual discernment to really think about how and why and what populations and communities have been marginalized long before you had that crunch or had that restriction or had that fear? And are you able to look at them and the truth-telling that they've done and the solutions that they've come up with to really enrich the collective? And are you willing to support them so that you can therefore support yourself, so that we can all be liberated and aligned to make good decisions about the future of this world? It really is an individualistic choice to think about someone beside yourself. And that is, yeah, that's difficult when we have fake news, when we are looking at a political climate that is not only increasingly polarized, but highly confused and really full of all sorts of back and forth mythologies that don't really have anything to do with the root cause of issues. It's difficult to take a breath, to be willing and able to do that. And I understand. I mean, I work 16-hour days and I raise two small girls, right? It's very hard, but that is the way out and in.
Well, that is the way out.
It
is. That is the way. That's the way forward.
It is the way forward.
And here's the thing. We all stand to learn so much. And I'm not going to, you know, present myself as someone who's done. I'm learning all the time. And each of us is. The point, essentially, it seems to me, Serena, that you're making is that it's time to reclaim this truth that has never, ever gone anywhere. We just haven't been paying attention.
Correct.
And that is that we are, every one of us, absolutely connected.
That's right.
And you can go so far as to say we really are all one. It's not just a cool Hallmark slogan.
Right.
It's the truth. And I really invite the listeners to check that out. What are your thoughts on that?
I think I completely agree. And I think that people are so tired. I think we should also be vulnerable in admitting how afraid we are. And that is creating a fatigue that's making us feel like we can't, that we can't have these conversations, that we can't try to understand better, and that we can't address our own behaviors because we are so fatigued by that fear. And what I encourage every listener, and what I'm working on better myself, is to call that out. Where is that fatigue draining me from having a consciousness that I think is necessary and critical for this world right now? And how can I take better care of myself so that I can read the news better, be better in terms of my responses to calls to action? And then frankly, as the CEO of an organization that's being enriched and led by youth voices, how can I make sure that I'm doing my job better? And that really isn't about how smart you are or how much you read or how politically affiliated you are. It's about your heart, right? It's about your heart. And it's also about, can you take a little bit of a time out to admit that that's really what's going on here? It's not, I'll be very blunt, it's not Joe Biden. It's not Donald Mm-mm. Trump. It's not Mm-mm. Make America Great Again. It's you. It's me. Are you able to take a small moment and realize I'm very scared? I am extremely exhausted. And that's preventing me from caring. And that's preventing me from seeing things and feeling respondent in an appropriate way. And so maybe instead of going and doing a lot of reading on bell hooks and doing a lot of reading on Black ecofeminism, you take some time to really look at yourself and think about it. I do not expect for anybody to go and take a seminar in women's studies 401 or start dissertating on any of those things. I'm not going to.
Well, and of course,
yeah.
Of course, they're welcome to. And we appreciate it if that's what you're doing. And there is this vital, if we're going to restore the climate, it's about, what about this, Serena? It feels like it's about falling in love with the earth and each other again. And not in sappy, silly Valentine's love, although that's fine too.
But,
sure. You know, really, truly understand, and using the word love is really a word for our interconnection.
It is. I'll say something else. I think one of the things right now that's happening is that the ego is really ruling the world as opposed to the heart. And that is difficult because people look at ego and intellectualism as the best way to problem solve through things, as opposed to the heart and really getting to that divine source of wisdom, that divine source of energy that really comes from the earth in terms of feeling calm, feeling regulated, feeling connected to the world, so that as a calm, regulated person, we can be resilient through conflict. We can be resilient through stress. We can address polarization and competing interest and what we consider to be resources and non-resources. But when we lean into the ego, we really do start digging our heels in and focusing on things that really aren't for the best of anyone. And I say this because as we are on the frontier of AI and tech, my opinion And I say this because we have amazing tech partners. We have amazing tech companies that fund our organization as well as the work that we do. One of the things that's true about tech and AI right now is that it's being so dominated in the conversation right now, in the news, in the future of the world. What that's also doing, in my opinion, is turning our head further away from the environment, right? And really kind of in this futuristic world where we're relying on machines and, you know, tech to do things for us and really kind of construct the way that we think about things. And I think what that's doing is it's also making it more difficult for us to think about the world and think about who we are as contributors, as opposed to relying on science and sort of, you know, tech figureheads and AI generators to do that for us. And it's really interesting what I think is happening in terms of the way that that dialogue is being constructed. It seems to be very dystopic and also preventing people. It's almost like people are surrendering to AI and tech as individual people who can be conscious. And it's really weird. And I see that for what it is. I think, you know, we have curriculum and we have policies on AI. We want girls and gender nonconforming, non-binary and trans people to be in the world of tech and science. 100%. But why and what that universe is doing for us as a collective is something that I am paying a lot of attention to.
Yeah, this is important too, because it perpetuates the separation from the natural world.
It really does.
This notion that we're separate, and it also feeds directly into the ego dominance.
It does.
So with that, we're coming to the end of our time, and with those things, oh, Serena, we could go on forever.
Forever.
I love to ask this question just at the close. What is a bit of advice, a bit of wisdom that you would leave listeners with at the close of this podcast? What would you suggest?
Be not apathetic. Apathy is conducive to destruction. Apathy is conducive to distraction. And apathy reduces one's belief in the greater good. And so if there's anything that I would ask of a listener, ask of ourselves, is to not be apathetic, but to be engaged and curious and full of positivity as we look at many of these things that are difficult, but are also not brand new. And have conversations and look at ways that have been identified by Black women and other women throughout history to solve these things. Your apathy is actually conducive to all of the problems in which we are experiencing more than any other reason as to why we're having problems. It is apathy. It is not one political party. It is not the 1% that is dominating, quote unquote, the economy throughout the world. It is individual apathy. And that is the way that the world, the environment, is going to be restored and is going to be able to function at a better level in tune with Earth, is if we avoid and do not fall prey to apathy. And that is what I worked in politics for a very long time in professional politics. I have also ran for office. I have served on all kinds of government commissions. I have found and funded political action committees. I am not shy to political construct. I am not shy to economic development. I am a person who's participated quite formidably in all of those things. With that being said, I have earned this honest opinion that we need to stay away from apathy. And that really is the biggest solution that we can join in together.
Well, thank you so much, Serena. Your voice is a jewel. It is a gift to all of us.
Thank you.
And I so appreciate its strength, because it is very comforting.
Thank you.
You're not going to stop talking.
No, I'm not. And why we are here.
I'm leading.
Yes, no, I'm not. I mean, I have a little bit of laryngitis that I've been dealing with all spring. And, you know, I've just said to myself, sometimes I shouldn't talk. I have to use my voice in different ways, right? But I want, while we are recording and here, to say thank you to you for your presence in this world. You were what we call, I call affectionately, the Dr. Founder of Girls Inc. of the Pacific Northwest. And also, you know, just the voice of wisdom that brought our organization to its founding, and then certainly was able to charter and become a part of the national fold of Girls Inc. But that, I would say, spiritual imprint and that wisdom that you imprinted upon us has been carried forth through the spirit of what we do. So thank you for that. I would not have the job that I have if it was not for you. Our youth would not have the safe space to be who they are in Oregon, Washington, if it was not for you. And thank you for continuing to rise to the common good and what you do and all of the work that you produce as a person in this world. You have my affection and my respect, and you have my support, and I'm so grateful for our time today. So thank you.
I'm blushing, and I'm affirmed. So yeah, thank you for that.
You are so welcome.
It's my joy. It is my joy, clearly, or I wouldn't. I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah, I think we're figuring it out.
I know, and I'm not apathetic.
No, you're not.
There you go. So, all right. Well, thank you, Serena. You can learn more about Serena Boston Ashby at the links in the show notes. In particular, check out her interview on the podcast At the Core, entitled Unapologetic Leadership. Serena is so worth learning from and with. Keep your eye on this radiant and generous leader for inspiration and sisterhood into the future. During our conversation, we referred, of course, to Girls Inc. of the Pacific Northwest, the organization for which Serena serves as CEO. It is true that back in 1996, I initiated a girls' leadership initiative in Portland that over many years, and with the love, sweat, tears, and cheers of many, has led to what today is the current organization and its service to thousands of girls and gender nonconforming, nonbinary, and trans youth. It is a joy to see what has come of this modest effort all those years ago. And now, before we go, a quick pitch for our podcast. If you like what you're hearing on How It Looks From Here, make sure to subscribe. Let's get these perspectives out there. Tell your friends and family. Share a link right now with someone you know would enjoy learning how it looks from another viewpoint. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcasts. How It Looks From Here is an educational project of Full Ecology. How It Looks From Here is produced by me, Mary Claire, editing by Gary Ferguson, music by Gary Ferguson, and other artists noted in the show notes. Find us on Instagram at Full Ecology and at www.fullecology.com. Keep listening and be in touch.